I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, two stories of war. Later in the hour, the impacts World War II had on Martha's Vineyard. We talk with the authors of Martha's Vineyard in World War II. First, a love story from World War I.
At the ebb of the Gilded Age, Quentin Roosevelt is a scion of America's most celebrated political families, and Flora, the privileged child of the Vanderbilt and Whitney families, two of the nation's wealthiest dynasties. Despite their very public personas, Quentin and Flora managed to become secretly engaged. Chip Bishop has written a new book about their relationship titled Quentin and Flora, a Roosevelt and a Vanderbilt in Love During the Great War. He joins us in our Woods Hole studio this morning. Good morning.
Hi, Mindy.
Of course, you're no stranger to the Roosevelt family. Your first book was The Lion and the Journalist, The Unlikely Friendship of Theodore Roosevelt and Joseph Buckland Bishop. And you're also a member of the Theodore Roosevelt Association. So how did you stumble across the story of Flora and Quentin?
Well, I was researching the first book a few years ago, and came across the time in Theodore's life when Quentin goes off to war. And it's a story that doesn't end well for Quentin or for Theodore. But it struck me because of what an emotional wallop it was to Theodore Roosevelt. In fact, he was dead within 6 months of the time he lost Quentin. And I thought, boy, there's a story here. I've just got to learn more about this. And my agent said to me, not only do you need to tell Quentin's story, but you need to tell the story of his fiancée, who was a Vanderbilt girl, and the relationship of those two great families.
Yeah. So Quentin's life was well documented because much of his youth was spent in the White House, although it wasn't the White House at that time, during Teddy Roosevelt's two terms as president. And we're going to talk more about Quentin in a bit. But first, let's talk about Flora Payne Whitney.
She is an heiress, as you mentioned, of the Vanderbilt and the Whitney families. She grew up in the most magnificent splendor that you could imagine of the early 20th century. The family had half a dozen homes, ranging from Fifth Avenue in New York to one we know well here, the Breakers, in Newport. And she lived a rather pampered life, didn't always go to school because her parents were traveling constantly to Europe. Her mother was an artist and developed an art gallery that became a great museum. I think Flora was a little isolated in her life growing up. And when she met Quentin in a social setting, her world opened up completely to her.
So in her younger years, as you're saying, kind of grew up, she really did not have knowledge of what was happening in the outside world. She lived in this sort of bubble in a way.
She did. It was a real cocoon. There was lots and lots of money, and it was being spent very freely. Her father was involved in international polo matches, and he would do things like ship 100 ponies to England so he'd have enough in reserve to win the international polo matches. Mm. She loved her father, but it was a somewhat distant relationship because the Vanderbilts and the Whitneys were focused on their lives and on spending money however they could for their own enjoyment.
Yeah. Tell us a little about Flora's personality.
She was, from what I can tell in the letters, a quiet girl. She didn't have a great relationship with her mother, although it developed over time. But they were distant. And I think where that changed is when her mother, who was Gertrude, her name was Gertrude, took Flora to Europe, to Paris in particular, where her mother had an art studio. And Flora began to flourish in that environment under the care of a governess. She made up for her lack of formal education by being a very excitable child, had a great imagination. She was a bit of a poetess. In time became someone that Quentin fell for madly.
Of course. Now, Quentin was about 4 years old when his father became president, and the family moves into the executive mansion. It wasn't called the White House just yet. So Quentin's antics with his friends in and around the White House were legendary. So tell us about little Quentin.
Well, I can read a short passage
sure.
from the book, which I think illustrates what we're talking about. He was a member of the White House gang, which was a group of seven of his chums from public school. The Roosevelts had put him in public school because they wanted him to mix with everyday working people, and it was a good experience for him. From chapter 8 in the book, it reads, "The gang often gravitated to the White House after school and on Saturdays under the watchful eyes of security men. They were often greeted by Quentin's father, who rarely passed up an opportunity for a romp with the boys when his schedule allowed, and sometimes when he shouldn't have. Quote, "For the last 3 days there has been snow," the president wrote to his childhood nurse Dolly Watkins around Christmas of 1905. "I have agreed to have a great play of hide-and-seek in the White House itself." Ever astute, the gang recognized that the mansion's attic was a singular place, cavernous and musty-smelling, inhabited by crawling creatures and cobwebs. There were ancient cedar chests stuffed with forgotten treasures going back to John Adams. Above all, the old attic was dark and spooky, the ideal place to play. One late winter afternoon, the gang assembled there to roughhouse. Suddenly, someone threw a light switch. Theodore Roosevelt appeared in the shadows, in shirt sleeves, his frock coat over an arm. As author Earl Looker remembered, it was a signal for a fight. "He threw the coat away and chased us," Quentin remembered, growling ferociously. "I was hiding behind a post and beheld Sailor Chu being closely pursued by T.R. I saw that he was going to be caught and at the same time saw the switch. I pulled it. There was immediate darkness, followed by wild shrieks of delight from the gang. Just then, we heard a loud smack. It was that irresistible president striking an immovable post. By George, T.R. bellowed from the center of the attic. Lights! Turn on the lights! This is worse than anything I've heard of in darkest Africa. As the brightness came up, there was the president leaning on the post, his hand cradling his face. He had collided with an upright and just missed a protruding nail. As Roosevelt descended from the attic to nurse himself, he muttered, "I'm quite all right, but never again turn off a light when anybody is near a post." With that, the gang set out to punish their member Earl Looker for injuring the president. Stuffing the boy into one of the cedar chests and sitting on the lid. In time, T.R. heard Looker's calls for help and returned to the attic, freeing him. "Shutting up boys in cedar chests for more than 60 seconds is strictly forbidden," he lectured. "Henceforth," the gang responded in unison. Quentin, who at all times had to have the last word, added, "forevermore." It's no wonder Roosevelt thought of his son as a cheerful pagan philosopher.
Well, this also says a lot about Teddy as a playful dad, doesn't it?
I mean, he was a terrific father. Yeah. He had six children in all. And as you can tell from that illustration, he was one of them in many ways. He always read to them. He was a voracious reader in his own right, mm-hmm. and wanted to share his love of books with them. And all the time while he was traveling, whether he was campaigning or on state visits or whatever, he would take time to write letters to his children. In fact, they were compiled by my great-granduncle Joseph Buckland Bishop in a book called Theodore Roosevelt's Letters to His Children. And they're a wonderful read. You can still get it.
Yeah. Quentin was a lot like Teddy.
I think that's what appealed to Theodore. He loved all of his children, but he had a special relationship with Quentin. He believed, in his heart of hearts, that Quentin could become his political heir. Not so much the other children, but Quentin had the personality, the intelligence, the looks, the charm, the feel for politics. And I think he had plans for Quentin. Once World War I was over and Quentin had a chance to come back, he believed that the future was limitless for him. And as I think about what could have been, it could very well have been Quentin Roosevelt who took us through World War II and not Franklin.
Right. Now, going back to the gang of seven there, as you're thinking of, they're running around in the White House, and I think there was an instant where they almost knocked over Van Buren's statue. They threw spitballs at the portrait of Andrew Jackson?
Andrew Jackson, yes, yes.
Which Teddy was not pleased with.
No, he wasn't. The story goes that Theodore Roosevelt was walking through the White House corridors one day and noticed this portrait of Andrew Jackson on the wall that was covered with spitballs. Well, Theodore figured out pretty quickly who had done this. But he waited until later that evening when Quentin was in bed and all his buddies were there for a sleepover. And he dragged Quentin out of bed and ordered him to remove the spitballs. And he later admonished him in front of his pals, "Just imagine how I would feel if you rowdies threw spitballs at my portrait," the president asked. Quentin deadpanned, "You wouldn't mind a bit. Besides, Andrew Jackson is dead."
Now, how Quentin and Flora actually met for the first time, we don't really know, right? But they probably ran in some of the same circles?
They did. I mean, their families were both New York-centered on the social circuit. Although they kept their distance, they did greet each other. They did go to parties, occasional dances. That's probably where they met. We don't know for sure. But the relationship really began to develop when Quentin was a freshman at Harvard and Flora was living with her family on Long Island. And the first of what are about 125 letters to each other began to be written. And at first, it was a very platonic relationship. Mm-hmm. They were boy-girl friends. But they would sneak away for time together at her place and sometimes even at Sagamore Hill and Roosevelt's home. And as you read the letters, which I did, and I found them all at Harvard, you see this relationship evolve from something that was a friendship to something much more than that.
And of course, back to the friendship days, we do know that Quentin was at her coming out party in Newport in 1916. He kind of, sort of, maybe invited himself.
Yeah, Flora made her debut in August of 1916 in Newport, and her parents invited 500 of their closest friends, who happened to be the richest and the most famous people in America. But 5 days prior to the debut, the ball, she had no escort. And she got in touch with him on this newfangled invention called the telephone. And she said, "Would you like to come to Newport to a dance?" Quentin really didn't have any idea it was this elaborate ball. But he accepted. That's probably the point where he first emerged from childhood obscurity, in a sense, to the world that she occupied. They had a wonderful time, and once they endured the formality of the debutante ball, they went swimming in Rhode Island Sound, and they toured around Ocean Drive in her roadster, and that probably sealed the relationship.
Yeah. Now, despite this, her family didn't necessarily think Quentin was the right choice for her. They were okay with the friendship, but once it started to become something more, they didn't think this was a good idea.
They worried about it because, remember, Theodore Roosevelt had clashed with the moneyed classes during his time as president. You remember his role as a trust buster. Part of what he busted was the railroad magnates, and, of course, the Vanderbilts were part of that family. They were suspicious of the Roosevelts to begin with, and I think more significantly, they understood that the Roosevelts, although they were comfortable, they were not in the moneyed class that the Vanderbilts and the Whitneys belonged to. So they weren't sure that he was quite good enough for their daughter.
Now, Flora's mother, as you mentioned, was Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney, both a patron to the arts and an artist herself. She went on to create the renowned Whitney Museum of American Art in New York. And, of course, Flora became, you know, this is much later, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but that's where most people might remember her from.
Yeah, exactly. Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney was an amazing woman. She was one of those Edwardian women who wanted to break out from the traditional role that was assigned to women in those days. She was a sculptor, she was an artist, and she was a patron of American artists. And she felt that while the whole world recognized and adored the work of the European masters, that we weren't paying much attention to the American artists. So she formed a small gallery in Greenwich Village, which in time evolved, as you mentioned, into the Great Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. Flora played a major role in the development of that museum over time.
Now, Gertrude also contributed greatly to the war effort. She underwrote the cost of a field hospital in France to the tune of $250,000, which doesn't sound like much, but that's equivalent to more than $5.5 million today. And she also worked in the hospital alongside volunteers.
Yes, she felt very strongly about the war effort because she loved France. She spent a lot of time there. She adored the French people and the art that many of them produced. And when the Germans were marauding through France and Belgium in World War I, she felt in her gut that she had to go there and do something. And she did. She went over and, as you mentioned, was very involved in the establishment of a field hospital and an ambulance corps there, and did not hesitate a moment to take out her checkbook and write for whatever was needed.
We're talking with Chip Bishop. His new book is Quentin and Flora, A Roosevelt and a Vanderbilt in Love During the Great War. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Chip Bishop, author of Quentin and Flora, A Roosevelt and a Vanderbilt in Love During the Great War. You write that around 1918, correspondence between Quentin and Flora evolves from this friendship we were talking about into love. And keeping with the times, Flora had carefully preserved most of the letters that she got from Quentin, but perhaps in typical male fashion, there weren't many letters from Flora to Quentin that remain, right?
That's true. Probably less than half of the letters that went over to Quentin were preserved. I mean, it was wartime. They were living in a mud hole. The troops were in eastern France, and it was hard to think about the future and posterity when you were fighting for your daily survival. But some of them are the most tender and beautiful sentiments that you will read from that era. I can think of one set of letters that occurred in 1917 when Quentin wrote to Flora, "You mean more to me than anyone else, far more than you can imagine." And she responded to him, "You lighten and color my dreams." Mm. How nice is that?
Yeah, it's very nice. Well, of course, throughout the country, young men were signing up to join the war, and it was no different for the Roosevelt family. Quentin, along with three of his brothers, voluntarily signed up, and Quentin fulfills a lifelong dream of becoming an aviator.
Correct. He loved aviation and mechanics from the time that he was a child. And when America became involved in World War I in April of 1917, he left school. He left Harvard and joined the U.S. Air Service and went to train in Mineola in New York and was shipped out to France. It was a very frustrating period for Quentin at the beginning. He was assigned to be a supply sergeant in a city called Issoudun near Paris. And he was such a good supply sergeant, organizing trucks and vehicles and supplies, that his commanding officers didn't want to send him to the front. Now, there were those who had the suspicion that he was protecting Theodore Roosevelt's son. That was not the case.
Well, thanks to a few strings, though, being pulled by his father, much of Quentin's military training is at that airfield in Long Island, close to the family's home at Sagamore Hill. And the Roosevelts, as we know, are a close family. And it's at this time that Quentin begins to invite Flora to Sagamore Hill. And she spends more time with his parents and kind of eventually wins them over, because they weren't too thrilled about this romance either until they spent some time with Flora.
Yeah, that's right. The Roosevelts were suspicious of great money. And the idle rich, as they called them. So they weren't real keen on bringing Flora into their family. But she won them over with her charm and her beautiful green eyes and her loving personality, to the point that at one time Quentin's mother, Edith, looked the other way when the two went upstairs by themselves to spend some private time together.
Yeah, and also to Quentin, he lit up around her. So as parents, you're thinking, well, gee, we kind of like her, and Quentin surely likes her. So that was part of this.
Yeah,
this.
Of course, the key event in their relationship was their secret engagement.
Mm-hmm.
They were in love. They wanted to marry. They were very worried about Quentin going off to war and possibly not returning. So the thought was that Quentin would bring Flora to France and that they would get married and perhaps have children in case something happened to Quentin. That marriage was not to be. There were rules at the time that forbade sisters of soldiers and girlfriends of soldiers from crossing the North Atlantic with all the U-boats and the attacks going on. So they never did marry, but they had a wonderful engagement, and it was very secret. It was between them and Quentin's brother, and I found a key letter that Flora's daughter shared with me. She is still living. She's in her late 80s, living in Connecticut. And I found a letter, the only letter that Quentin and Flora wrote together, and it was to Quentin's brother. And they wrote in this letter, "We have decided for our manifold sins and wickedness to become engaged. Breathe not a word." And your imagination wonders what that wickedness really was.
Right. So, and as you said, they kept this. It was they shared it with Kermit, and they kept it a secret for a while from both families. But eventually they did tell the Roosevelt family.
Yeah, it was hard to keep a secret like that.
Sure.
Especially with Quentin in Europe and Flora back home. And both families eventually came around to the idea that this would be a good idea. And Theodore tried so hard, as did Flora's father, to bend the rules so Flora could get to Europe to marry Quentin. But it was not to be.
Not to be, right. So Quentin receives his order to be shipped abroad. And this point, as you mentioned, this is where his letters to Flora begin to mention the possibility of his death. So it's something he clearly is thinking about.
Yeah, he had a preoccupation, I guess you might say, with death from the time he was probably high school age. It was something he wrote about in poems and stories. Replete throughout his letters are references to "if I don't come back" or "just in case I don't come back, my things will be in a trunk and there will be a letter there and my best friend Hamilton Coolidge will see to it that those go back to my family." It was a worrisome time. It was a time of great threat and great danger.
Sure, of course. Now, as you mentioned, Quentin spent some time in France, and he isn't immediately sent to the front. And that causes a little strife in the normally close-knit Roosevelt family.
Boy, did it ever. This was the most surprising thing that I found in my research, is this family almost came apart over Quentin's service in France. As I mentioned, he was a supply officer for a year and did not see combat. His brothers, Ted and Archie, were in fact with the infantry on the front, at the front. Both of those brothers were injured, were shot, were gassed during the war. Quentin was seen to be safely tucked in the back, worrying about trucks and ammunition and gasoline. So one of his brothers, Archie, actually accused him in a letter, direct letter to him, of being a slacker. And the French word for that is embusqué. And Quentin took great umbrage at this because he was not a slacker. He was trying very hard to get to the front. But he was so good at what he did, he couldn't seem to break out of it. Well, this caused a great rift, as you can imagine, within the Roosevelt family. His mother got involved. His sister got involved. Finally, Theodore got involved, and he put an end to this. And he wrote to Quentin and said, "Perhaps your only sin is trying too hard to get to the front. We support you and are totally proud of you." That ended the discussion.
So as we've mentioned, Flora eventually tells her parents about her engagement to Quentin. And as we mentioned, they're not immediately supportive, but they do come around. And Teddy Roosevelt plays a role in this.
He actually took Mr. Whitney to lunch one day. We don't know what was discussed at lunch. I would love to have been a fly on the wall that day or in the soup that day. But as a result of that lunch, Mr. Whitney agreed that they should try to arrange this trip to Europe for Flora. And he tried to pull his strings in the world that he lived in. Theodore tried to pull his strings in the political world, but it was not to be.
Yeah. And it's interesting that these two powerful men on different circles were not able to make this happen. And this was a regulation that passed that prohibited women 25 and younger from traveling to France to do war work. Why? Why 25 and younger?
the powers to be at the time thought that the women would be a distraction for the men. They didn't understand the contributions they were making to the Red Cross and to the other organizations that were supporting the troops in France. They had this sort of narrow view of women at the time and didn't want their troop ships, their transport ships, to be clogged up with these young women going to Europe. Also, I think there was a factor where they worried about what would happen to a boatload of young women who were going to Europe if it got torpedoed by the Germans and what the fallout from that would be. So they decided it would be better to keep them at home.
Right. So Quentin is eventually sent to the front, and in a dogfight with the Germans, his plane goes down over France and he's killed.
Yeah, it's a real sad ending to the story, and more than a few people have told me that the pages of the book are stained with tears when they get to this part of the story. The good news, if there is good news coming out of this, was the survival of Flora. She was surrounded by what she termed unspeakable grief when she lost Quentin, but the Roosevelts rallied around her tremendously. They brought her to their bosom. Theodore actually hired her to be his secretary at one point to give her productive work to do. She went on to have a rather amazing life. She married twice afterward. Her first marriage was to a pal of Quentin's. Some of the cynics said she married the uniform. Mm. But she married for good later on and stayed with Miller for over 40 years. But she was the driving force behind the growth and development of the Whitney Museum of American Art.
Now, the letters from Flora that Quentin had with him when he was killed allowed the Germans to positively identify his body.
That's right. When Quentin fell in France, the Germans who were occupying that part of France at the time went through his things, and they found letters from Quentin, from Flora, excuse me. And they immediately realized that this was the son of the most famous man in the world at the time, who was Theodore Roosevelt. And they gave him a ceremonial burial right there in the fields of France. The stories say that up to 1,000 German soldiers had assembled for the ceremony to honor not only his sacrifice as a flyer, but to honor his father.
And it's interesting because the law, or I guess process at the time, you know, was to bring soldiers' remains back to the United States when they could. And the Roosevelt family said, no, we want them to remain where he died.
Right. They believed very strongly that a fighter should lie where he fell. And they decided that Quentin should remain in Chamray, France, this tiny little village. And he did lay there for 37 years until his sister-in-law decided that he should be removed to the American cemetery in Normandy to lie next to his older brother, Ted, who was a World War II hero. And in 1955, Quentin's remains were transferred from Chamray to Normandy. And to this day, he remains the only World War I soldier buried in the American cemetery.
Now, as we mentioned, Theodore Roosevelt, who had been in poor health for years, dies in 1919. So this is before he can travel to Quentin's grave in France. So this left his wife, Edith, with the monument to build at his grave.
Yes. Theodore was dead within 6 months of Quentin's death, and it fell to his mother, Edith, to journey to France to visit his gravesite. And in one of the most poignant scenes of the book, another author describes how she trekked up that hill, and I trekked up that hill along with my wife last May in France, so I know what she went through. And she knelt very silently at his grave and said the Lord's Prayer and put some flowers at his grave, and then decided that Quentin needed a greater monument, not to him necessarily, but to the sacrifice that Americans made in World War I. So she had this marvelous stone fountain built in his honor right along the side of the road in Chamray. It remains there today. The villagers still use it for water. They bring their cattle there to water. And Quentin strongly remains a symbol of what America did for France in both World Wars.
Yeah. And it's so sad when you have, you know, these two people who fall in love, who seem so perfect for each other. And, of course, Fleur was just 20 when Quentin was killed. And as you mentioned, despite that failed marriage, the first marriage, her second marriage does endure, and she shepherds the Whitney Art Museum. But then, of course, the story makes you wonder, as you said, what if Quentin had lived and he and Flora were married? And, you know, what would have been the impact of the union between the Vanderbilt and Roosevelt families? And, you know, would Quentin have followed in his father's footsteps into a career in politics? A lot of what ifs.
A lot of what ifs. And, of course, it was at the dawn of the Jazz Age, which was a great time in American history. And some of my friends have urged me to write a fictional piece based on the what-ifs. What if Quentin had lived? What if they had married? What if the Roosevelts and the Vanderbilts had come together?
What an interesting idea.
Yeah. But, you know, once you write nonfiction, it's pretty tough to jump into fiction. And then people don't know who you are.
Yeah. Well, I remember when you were writing the first book and you mentioned coming across these letters between Quentin and Flora and thought, wow, there's a whole nother story here. Anything when you were working on the Quentin and Flora book that you said, uh-oh, here's another story I might be able to take off on?
Oh, boy. Not really. As I was reading these letters, my mind kept churning about the rest of the story and how we could tell this in a credible way without being maudlin about it and without being too phantasmagorical. Mm-hmm. That's a word. And maybe it's a magazine article. I don't know. Yeah. But it's certainly a fascinating possibility.
The book is Quentin and Flora, A Roosevelt and a Vanderbilt in Love During the Great War. Chip Bishop, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up next, Martha's Vineyard in World War II.